It's under our current president. And that will have Marianne Lavelle of Insight Climate News and Brett Court of Clean Wisconsin. And of course, as with a public affair, you can talk to the people that are on the air, ask questions, make comments, and that's one of the great values that WRT gives to its community, this space for discussion, this space for learning. So if you appreciate that, still time to do a contribution at WRTFM.org. And thank you, thank you, thank you again. We'll catch you next week.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The Trump administration has confirmed that it's cutting the vast majority of overseas aid programs run by USAID. The Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, wrote in his personal account on X that it was an overdue and historic reform. From Washington, Nomia Iqbal reports.
In a social media post, Marco Rubio said 83% of programs at the agency will be cancelled and the rest folded into remaining programs under the State Department. He said 5,200 contracts spent tens of billions of dollars in ways that did not serve America and in some cases harmed the US, but he didn't provide any details. USAID gives billions of dollars globally in an effort to alleviate poverty, treat diseases, and respond to famines and natural disasters. Former officials for the agency said this move could lead to destabilization and threats to national security.
President Zelensky has arrived in Saudi Arabia, ahead of talks between the US and Ukraine that could lead to a peace deal with Russia. The negotiations are taking place days after the US cut military aid to Kyiv. Our Europe regional editor Warren Bull reports.
Volodymyr Zelensky will not directly take part in Tuesday's negotiations with an American delegation, but his involvement is vital to their progress. It's only days since the White House row when President Trump accused Mr. Zelensky of wanting to continue the war and cut aid to Kyiv. Since then, Russia has intensified its attacks on Ukraine, with some success. On arrival in Jeddah, Mr. Zelensky was quick to stress Ukraine's commitment to peace. The US Secretary of State Marco Rubio also expressed optimism about the talks, but said a minerals deal with Kyiv was still some way off.
It's now thought that at least 6,000 Syrians have crossed into neighbouring Lebanon in the last few days to escape violence in the coastal provinces of Latakia and Tartus. The area is a stronghold of the ousted former President Bashar al-Assad, and hundreds of civilians were killed there by the new government's security forces. People told the BBC they'd fled for their lives. A major rescue operation is continuing off the east coast of England after an American and a Portuguese ship collided in the North Sea. The American tanker was carrying aviation fuel. More than 30 casualties have been brought ashore. Our correspondent Rowan Bridge has more details.
What we have had in the last hour or so is a statement from the owners of one of the vessels involved, the Stena Immaculate, the oil tanker, saying that there were multiple explosions on board the tanker and it is now pouring jet fuel into the sea. The Coast Guard say they are now assessing what pollution response might be needed.
World News from the BBC. Britain and Germany have urged Israel to restore power supplies to the Gaza Strip. They warned that the decision on Sunday to cut electricity risked breaching Israel's obligations under international humanitarian law. Germany said it could create a further humanitarian crisis. Stock markets in the United States have fallen sharply in early trading as investors worry about the US economy and the impact of President Trump's tariffs. The losses come after Mr. Trump refused to rule out the possibility of a recession in an interview with Fox News broadcast on Sunday. Here's our North America business correspondent, Aaron Delmore.
We're seeing the declines from last week follow us into the beginning of this trading week with sharp declines in all three major U.S. indexes. In fact, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ are both posting their lowest numbers in 6 months. And that sell-off is led by the Magnificent Seven stocks, the big tech giants that are normally booming. And we're seeing, in fact, the biggest drops today with Tesla down about 10%.
The far-right Romanian politician Calin Georgescu has appealed against a ban on him taking part in the rerun presidential election in May. The Constitutional Court's decision on Sunday to bar the front-runner triggered violent protests in the capital Bucharest. The UN's migration agency says nearly 400,000 Sudanese people have returned to their homes in the last 3 months. The agency said almost all of these were in Sinnar and Al Jazeera states south of the capital Khartoum. Many returned to looted and burned out homes after 2 years of civil war. Around 1,000 people have been evacuated from towns near Guatemala's Fuego volcano after it started erupting overnight. Schools were suspended and the road leading to the UNESCO site of Antigua was closed as the volcano sent a cloud of ash and rocks into the sky. BBC News.
YWCA Madison invites you to join them to celebrate the 22nd annual Circle Fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center from 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. YWCA Madison is eager to gather with their community of supporters to share stories that speak to who they are and demonstrate their values of humanity, community, growth, and restoration, which are at the heart of how they move as an organization. Attending the Circle fundraiser impacts the lives of thousands of women, children, and families who are served each year through YWCA's transformational programs in housing and shelter, employment and transportation, restorative justice, and learning and movement building. More information about the Circle fundraiser and other YWCA programs and resources can be found at ywcamadison.org. That's the 22nd annual Circle fundraiser on Thursday, March 20th at the Alliant Energy Center. Keeping you informed of community events and resources, this is WORT 89.9 FM and WORTFM.org.
6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to place.
Welcome to A Public Affair. I'm your Monday host, Douglas Haynes. A huge thank you to everyone who donated during WORT's successful spring pledge drive. If you weren't able to donate, we still have a matching grant that will double all online donations made this week, and all thank you gifts are still available for online donations. If you'd like to support the independent community radio voices of WORT, you can donate online at www.wortfm.org. We appreciate it, and we appreciate, again, all of you who made last week's pledge drive so successful. On today's show, we'll pick up where we left off last week, looking at the impacts of new Trump administration orders and initiatives on the natural world and human community resilience and health. Today, we'll focus on climate with a local expert from the nonprofit Clean Wisconsin and the Washington Bureau Chief with the award-winning nonprofit news organization Inside Climate News. We'll follow the lead of Inside Climate News' website, Trump 2.0, The Reckoning, which provides a vital catalog of, in the site's words, the rollbacks, cutbacks, policy revisions, and gathering climate crisis since Trump took office. We'll take a comprehensive look at climate-related actions on both the federal and state levels, and we'll talk about how people concerned about the climate crisis can productively respond, as they did during the Stand Up for Science rallies this past Friday here in Madison and across the world. If you'd like to join our conversation today, we'd love to have your voice included. Please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd be happy to field your questions and concerns. First, let me introduce my guest today. We have with us in the studio Brett Cordy, who is staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin. His work focuses on air, climate, and energy issues impacting Wisconsin's communities and environment. Welcome to A Public Affair, Brett.
Thanks, Douglas. It's great to be here.
And we also have with us on the line from Washington, D.C., Marianne Lavelle, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the award-winning nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization Inside Climate News. She has covered the environment, science, law, and business in Washington, D.C. for more than three decades. Welcome to A Public Affair, Marianne.
Hi, thanks for having me.
We're really excited to have you both with us today to cover some territory that is definitely in big news outlets these days, but you might have to do some looking to find it sometimes with so much change in the air. So that's why we thought we'd do this show today to mirror sort of that clearinghouse of information that Inside Climate News has created for us on all the changes to climate-related policies and initiatives in the last month or so. We're going to start that effort today with you, Marianne, to just give us an overview of the many Trump administration efforts to change or undo climate regulations and policies at the federal level.
Yes, it's many pronged. And the way to look at it, you know, we kind of divided up the Biden administration, of course, made a historic federal investment in the energy transition. And I think there is just as historic a disinvestment going on right now. And so we've been looking at all of these grants financing really these contracts were already signed with many grantees. People are finding they can't access their grants. The EPA has...
The Environmental Protection Agency.
Right. The Environmental Protection Agency has said some of the investments has argued that they're illegal. The so-called Green Bank, they have begun a criminal investigation into that. So there's all this effort in many different ways to bring back money. And of course, Congress is considering rescinding the biggest support of all, which is all of these tax incentives for wind energy, solar energy, including ethanol, every form of energy got some sort of support from the IRA. The Inflation Reduction Act, which was the big bill that Biden shepherded through Congress. The other thing that's going on another track is deregulation, and with not only getting rid of restrictions on pollution from power plants and from cars and trucks, but really getting rid of the whole legal foundation for the government to act on that kind of pollution. And we could talk more about that. And then there's just this whole other arena of things that are going on, restricting what people say about climate, restricting what data there is about climate, and really historic cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency being considered, cut back in their staff that really would bring it back to, pre-1970 levels. So this is all going on at the same time. And there's no way that's not going to have an effect on the energy transition.
Thank you for that great overview, Marianne. Brett, we're going to turn to you now just to tell us, again, sort of analogous overview at the state level, what all this means at the state level in Wisconsin right now, and what your biggest climate-related policy and regulatory concerns are from what Marianne just described.
Yeah, so the Trump administration's moves will certainly have impacts here in Wisconsin. The endangerment finding for carbon emissions that was mentioned, if that's rolled back, we'll certainly see the impacts. But right now, it's kind of unclear, right? A lot of this rollback of federal funding, a lot of it's being challenged. It's unclear what's going to kind of stand the test of time. We're really grateful for folks like Mirian who are keeping track of all this stuff for us. But it's important to note that things aren't fully kind of settled yet, and we'll have to kind of see what the lay of the land is going forward. I can add that, you know, we are watching closely what happens with the Inflation Reduction Act. Like Mirian said, that is the biggest investment in climate mitigation that the United States has ever made. And a lot of those policies are helping folks out here in Wisconsin and helping out the state of Wisconsin already. And, you know, we'll certainly be watching to see if Congress has the appetite to do anything about the investment tax credits or some of the other IRA programs.
Sorry, but when you say investment tax credits, like tax credits for things like buying an electric car or heat pumps, those sorts of
exactly.
things.
Yeah, exactly. There's tax credits that are aimed for more the household level, mm-hmm. like the EV electric vehicle tax credit. There's incentives for energy efficiency and different things folks can do to not only, you know, help out with climate mitigation, but also make investments in their own homes and in their own lives to save money ultimately. And then there's bigger investment tax credits for large scale solar, wind development, those kinds of projects. And we've really seen a boon in big renewable projects in Wisconsin over the last, you know, 10, 15 years. So far, those continue apace. We'll see if federal policy will slow those down. But we're kind of on a roll here. We're really starting to see the benefits of large-scale solar. We're seeing some big wind projects be proposed. And those are really helping Wisconsin move away from fossil fuels. The listeners might know this, but Wisconsin doesn't have any oil, doesn't have any coal that we produce here. So we spend about $14 billion a year just on the fuels that we use for our electrical generation in the state. And the more that we're able to rely on solar and wind right here in Wisconsin, but also access renewables in, say, further west in the Dakotas, Iowa, where there's a lot of wind, the more we're able to bring that online, the more we can cut back on that $14 billion that we're spending annually. And, you know, I'm sure a lot of folks can think of things that we'd like to spend that on in Wisconsin rather than fossil fuels we really don't need.
Yeah, thank you, Brett, for that local picture. We're going to go back to you, Mirian. And you have something to add about sort of what's happening now in Congress, specifically with those incentives Brett was just describing.
Exactly. This is something that just happened over the last day. One of my colleagues is writing about it, so you can check it out on our website later today. But 21 House Republicans have come out and written a letter that they want to preserve some of these sector-wide energy incentives. And particular, if you look who's on those letters, particularly Republicans in the Midwest, where there's a lot of wind energy and just a lot of folks relying on that and have made decisions relying on. And one of the major things that the IRA did was make those wind energy incentives extended them out in time so they weren't changing every year, which was a real issue for the industry. There would be some stability of process. And these members and 21 House members who are Republicans, that's very significant because the Republicans only have, a two or three member majority. And they're not going to be able to get anything through that has 21 of their own members, you know, say, we don't want to give that away. However, I will say this, if you talk individually to some of those Republicans, well, they like the ethanol parts of the bill and the wind energy incentives, but they don't like the electric vehicle incentives. So it's not like they're ready to protect everything. So you're still going to see a lot of debate and pulling one way and another on these incentives. And the administration really does, and many conservative Republicans want to get rid of all of them.
So it sounds like there's going to be a discussion within the Republican Party, but perhaps some resistance against a wholesale elimination of the Inflation Reduction Act when that comes to the table here. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM. I'm Douglas Haynes, and I'm talking today with Marianne Lavelle of Inside Climate News and Brett Cordy of Clean Wisconsin about federal rollbacks of climate regulation and policy. If you have a question for my guests or want to share a perspective on threats to the climate or adaptation to climate change in Wisconsin and beyond, please give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We'd love to hear from you. Brett, I'm going to go back to you while we're on the subject of renewable energy. Tell us a little bit more about the landscape of renewable energy in Wisconsin. You mentioned that there have been a lot of big projects. A lot of people have been under the impression for a long time that renewable energy had an uphill battle in terms of cost and scaling up. Maybe you could update us about that a little bit. And then I think a link up to that issue of continued investment in fossil fuel infrastructure and where that's at in Wisconsin.
Yeah, for sure. So I think the reason we didn't see a ton of solar in particular in Wisconsin, say 20 years ago, was because the places that had kind of better climates, better weather for it, were being selected first by the developers, right? These are either utilities or private companies that are making economic decisions about where to put these projects. And as the technology has improved, as the costs have gone down on, say, solar cells or the other components that go into these facilities, we saw Wisconsin become a viable place for it economically. So we have seen a lot of investment in solar in particular. And like I said, we're seeing more and more wind looking at our state. And the utilities here in Wisconsin have really come to rely on renewables as a big part of their portfolios in the moment right now and also looking forward. So that's kind of already happening, and we're already on a roll. Obviously, rolling back some of these tax incentives through the IRA would impact that. But we're hopeful that we continue to see those projects come to Wisconsin and be approved by our Public Service Commission. You know, they've got a lot of other benefits aside from just mitigating climate change. Like I've already mentioned, wind and solar is the cheapest way to produce electricity that we have. So it's a good investment no matter how you feel about climate change. These projects also bring a lot of revenue to local communities. We've got provisions in state law where any kind of electrical generation facility, and particularly solar and wind, are directly paying benefits to towns, counties, any local municipalities that are hosts to those projects. And we're seeing communities across the state really embrace that funding, and it's helping them meet budget shortfalls in other places. We've seen a lot of local communities struggle. And these projects are big economic boons, not just the direct payments, but the jobs they bring to the communities, the economic development that's associated with the construction and maintenance of these facilities. And I think that's why you're seeing people in Congress hesitate to kind of go all in on repealing the IRA, because these benefits are already there. A lot of our big renewable projects are in rural areas. That's where there's land for this. And it's also, you know, farmers and other landowners are choosing to be parts of these projects. They're agreeing to lease their land or sell their land. Mostly it's leasing. And we've heard from a lot of farmers that being part of one of these projects is allowing them to, you know, keep the family farm in the family. It's another revenue stream that is more secure than a lot of other agricultural industries. So, the benefits are wide ranging, and we really hope that folks see the value in the IRA.
So what I'm hearing you say, Brett, is that regardless of what's happening on the federal level per se, this momentum towards investing in renewable energy, at least on the state level, you see it continuing for the time being.
Yeah, and that's not to say we don't have other issues.
Yeah.
We've seen WEC, our biggest investor-owned utility in the state, is proposing a gas build-out. Right now, they're seeking approval of two gas plants that total about 1,300 megawatts, which is pretty significant, new gas plants that they want to build. And, you know, there's other factors impacting that. These plants were proposed well before Trump won the election. We're seeing new energy loads from things like data centers that are kind of coming in on top of what we already knew was happening, which is the need for more electricity to facilitate electrification of cars, of furnaces, of other things. So we knew that that electrification was going to be part of the transition and that we were going to need more electricity than we're currently using. And then these big energy users like data centers are kind of coming in on top of that in a moment where if it wasn't for these data centers and other large load users, a lot of utilities might be looking at renewables, but you know, they would say they don't think they can build it fast enough and that the power from these renewable generation sources aren't kind of steady enough to meet these very high demands that are basically running 24/7, 365 for a data center, for example. So while the federal stuff is important and we're closely tracking it, it's you know, not necessarily the only force driving what we're seeing happening on the energy side of things.
A complicated picture, it sounds like, for renewable energy adaptation right now, both statewide and nationally. We have a lot of different subsets of this climate policy conversation to address, and so far we've focused mostly on the impacts of the Inflation Reduction Act and various kinds of incentives for renewable energy and making that energy transition. Let's shift gears a little bit here and go back to you, Marianne, and talk about the Environmental Protection Agency's ability to enforce regulations that currently exist. We mentioned at the top the effort to remove greenhouse gases from the EPA's jurisdiction of regulation. Let's start there and dive into that a little bit more so folks understand what can seem like sort of a policy wonky kind of topic.
Yes, and we'll try not to make it too wonky, but people probably remember there was a big rollback of regulations during the first Trump administration. The Trump administration this time is looking at going much, much further. It's not that they want to put weaker greenhouse gas regulations in place to replace old, strong regulations. They want to take out any greenhouse gas regulations at all. And they're doing that by targeting something that's called, and Brett mentioned this, the endangerment finding. And this, again, it may sound wonky, but basically in 2009, the Obama administration put out a legal finding that greenhouse gas emissions were a danger to public health and welfare. The Clean Air Act says, and this goes back to 1970, the Clean Air Act says if there is a legal finding that something is, some air pollutant is a danger to health and welfare, EPA has a mandate to regulate it. And so once that finding was made in 2009, the Obama administration proceeded with regulations on pollution from motor vehicles, pollution from power plants, methane pollution, which is a very powerful greenhouse gas from oil and gas installations. And so all of that came from this finding. And now, if you think of it, the administration, when there's far, far more evidence that greenhouse gases are a danger to health and the environment, the Trump administration is thinking of getting rid of that. And it seems like they can't possibly hope to win that argument in the courts. But what we think from talking to people is they're not going to take on climate science so much as they're going to argue that when Congress passed the Clean Air Act, they never planned to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and greenhouse gas emissions are too big of a thing to regulate under one provision of the Clean Air Act. And it's a very, very legalistic argument. A lot of folks think it's not a very good legal argument, but
the Trump administration's argument.
Yes. Okay. But there is some support for that view, a very narrow view of the federal government's authority. There's some support for that on the current Supreme Court. And so we really have to see, as with so many things, how this plays out, because it is a very, could be a very serious reduction in the federal government's role on greenhouse gases.
Thank you for that really clear, broad explanation, Marianne. I want to give Brett a chance to respond in a minute, but we do have a caller on the line, so we're going to get him in first. Glenn is on the line with a question about incentives and rebates in particular in Wisconsin. Welcome to Public Affair, Glenn. Thanks for your patience.
If you want to just change the radio station. Well, hello?
Are you there, Glenn?
Yes, thank you. Just wanted to ask if the guests know anything about the status of, in Wisconsin, the homes and the HERE programs for rebates for heat pumps. We contacted two contractors here locally in Madison at the end of last year, and one of them had taken on three heat pumps, and he said he wasn't going to take on any more until he found out whether he was actually going to get the money and the person having it installed would get the rebate. And then another contractor came out and was going to, you know, talked about installing the heat pump, and then a week or two later, corporate at his business said that they weren't going to do the homes program. So what's the status? I mean, we're in limbo. You know, we're all ready to apply. We've already done all the online stuff, and we're just waiting to find out whether or not, supposedly, the funds are in Wisconsin, but are they actually being released? And are people getting heat pumps installed and getting the rebates? And are the contractors being reimbursed for what they would be getting under the programs?
Thank you so much for calling in, Glenn, with that question. It sounds, from what I hear, like maybe there's some preemptive activity going on in terms of installers saying, we're not sure about this, whether we're going to get the money back that, because they pay up front, I assume, for the installation. Do you have any knowledge about this, Brett, or about the status of the rebates?
Yeah, a little bit. Thanks, Glenn. That's a great question, and I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to give you just a quick, simple, direct answer. As you've caught on, there's a lot of stuff going on. These two programs, the HERES and HOMES programs, were part of the IRA, and they're very specific to kind of like household things people can do, like the heat pumps that Glenn is talking about. Generally, if the money's out the door and with the states, it should be able to be accessed. So, you know, it is concerning to hear that a contractor is not so sure about that. Since I can't tell you for sure what's going on, I do know that other folks at Clean Wisconsin, we've got a couple people who are really focused on these types of rebates. So you can check out our website and talk with them. There's other organizations in Wisconsin also working to spread the word about these rebates and let people know how they can access them. So hopefully there are some good resources out there, and you could start with our website or contact us, and we'll let you talk to the right people that can help you figure out what's going on. I mean, there's a ton of uncertainty, and that's kind of the problem here. Until things kind of get settled out, it doesn't surprise me to hear that some contractors might be hesitant to go forward with something with everything that they're hearing.
Marianne, do you want to add something to that real quick?
Yeah, I mean, you said it, this preemptive sort of backing off of the incentives is very concerning. But you can understand why contractors are doing this, and it's happening throughout industry. It's folks say, I don't know where things are headed. I don't know what's happening. Everything seems up in the air. I'm not going to commit to something without knowing. And so this in and of itself is a disincentive for the clean energy transition. And we'd love to say, Glenn or anyone else who is experiencing something like that, go to our website. My email address is there, my colleagues as well. We would love to write about this problem, this kind of preemptive backing off of the incentives before, the Congress has made the decision on what to do about them.
And that's the Inside Climate News website you're referring
right, to. Right, insideclimatenews.org. Okay, yep.
Thank you, Marianne. And thanks again for the call, Glenn. I hope that helped us to some degree. And I want to bring in another caller who's not on the line who also left a question. This is another Wisconsin-specific question. It's Chris called and asked, is We Energies still going to open a methane plant in Kenosha? Do you have any information on that, Brett?
So the two that are currently pending before the Public Service Commission are one's in the town of Paris, so along the corridor there, and then the other is at the existing Oak Creek coal plant facility. So if Chris is referring to the Paris plant, that's pretty close down there, but I'm not sure about anything else in Kenosha. There's other kind of plants that have been hinted at, almost double, doubling again the megawattage that they're looking for over the next few years. So it could be one of those. But the two that are active right now from We Energies are the Paris plant and Oak Creek. And both of those are, like I said, before our Public Service Commission in Wisconsin. And I believe they're actually still accepting public comments, at least on the Oak Creek plant. So you can visit Clean Wisconsin's website to find out how to learn about those projects and how you can have your voice heard. All the information is available on the Public Service Commission website as well.
That is Brett Cordy with Clean Wisconsin, staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin, here on A Public Affair on WRT 89.9 FM. I'm Douglas Haynes. I'm talking today with Brett and Marianne Lavelle of Inside Climate News about federal rollbacks or proposed rollbacks of climate regulation and policy. If you have a question for my guests or want to share a perspective on threats to the climate in Wisconsin and beyond or efforts to address climate change, give us a call at 608-256-2001, extension 9. We've still got plenty of time this hour for you to join the conversation, and we much appreciated those callers who called in with their questions already. Brett, we're going to go back to you now to return to the issue of the greenhouse gases that previously were able to be regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, and now there is a Trump administration effort to restrict or remove that ability of the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide, methane, and other greenhouse gases. You want to share anything more about this whole litigation world around that right now?
Yeah, so Marianne did a great job giving it an overview of it, but I would go back just a couple years before the Obama administration issued its endangerment finding to the 2007 Supreme Court case, Massachusetts versus EPA. And that was a lawsuit brought by the state of Massachusetts and other states that were basically trying to force the federal government to do something about climate change. They were saying basically, as states, we can't do this alone, and we're seeing the impacts of climate change. So feds, we need you to step in and do something. And what the Supreme Court ruled in 2007, so remember, this is under the George W. Bush administration. First, they found that, yep, Massachusetts has the standing, the ability to bring that lawsuit and had, viable claims. And second, they found that EPA can regulate greenhouse gases as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. Marianne discussed a little bit about the kind of theory of how they could attack that, which would be, well, back in the 70s when the Clean Air Act was passed, we didn't know anything about greenhouse gases, so clearly Congress didn't mean for, you know, that to be regulated. I think that the Supreme Court in 2007 addressed that pretty directly, where they found that the Clean Air Act was designed to kind of account for air pollutants that weren't necessarily top of mind in 1970. And you can argue if, you know, climate change really was not issue back then. I don't think it was. We've seen plenty of evidence that people knew and knew something should be done about it. But the Supreme Court very clearly said the EPA has the authority. And then they said, because they do have the authority and it is a regulated pollutant, EPA must make an endangerment finding. So that was the Supreme Court telling EPA they had to do it. And, you know, just because of the time it takes, that ultimately happened under the Obama administration. So, again, Marianne did a great job of kind of laying out the arguments, but I just thought it was important to note that it would actually take probably the Supreme Court overruling itself from not that long ago to find that they're, you know, the endangerment, they don't need to have an endangerment finding on greenhouse gases. And as Marianne said, the endangerment finding is based off the science. So I have a really hard time figuring out how the Trump administration would prove scientifically that greenhouse gases aren't a threat. So we'll see what happens. I think there's other options they could take, like we saw under the first Trump administration, where they just say, well, we're not going to do much about it because it's hard, basically. But we'll see if the endangerment finding stands. I think it is an uphill battle for anyone trying to kind of roll that back.
Is there currently a path that heads this back to the Supreme Court in terms of litigation?
I mean, the path would be set the moment they make an endangerment finding.
Okay.
You know, that nothing is rescinded. Nothing
right.
has happened yet. I would fully expect the lawsuits to be kind of fast and furious if that were to happen. And yeah, we'll just have to see.
Yeah. Well, in our 20 minutes left here, we still have so much possible ground to cover. I think we would be remiss not to talk a little bit about the impacts of cuts to staffing at the federal level, both at the EPA and in NOAA and elsewhere. Marianne, you wrote a story recently entitled EPA Would Shrink to 1970 Staffing Levels When the Skies Were Dark with Smog Under Proposed Plan. Tell us about the current status of plans to cut the EPA and what the implications of this are.
Well, they're in progress at the EPA and really every federal agency and a lot of them that have to do with climate change, including, I don't want to forget NOAA, for instance. They are very, very much under the gun. But the president picked out the EPA in particular at this publicly broadcast cabinet meeting to say that the plan is for 65% cut in people, is the word he used, at EPA. And later on that night, the White House came back and clarified and said, well, he meant 65% budget cut. And that would be even more than the EPA. If you look at inflation adjusted figures, the EPA has never had a budget that low compared to even if you go back to 1970 or the low point in the mid 70s, it just would be a stunning reduction in the EPA's presence. And of course, the EPA's presence grew over that time because of demand from the public for action. I'm old enough to remember Love Canal and the toxic waste in neighborhoods. The EPA doesn't have 1970s level staffing today. They have higher staffing in part because toxic waste laws were passed. And we passed acid rain program that has been very successful in reducing acid rain. And you can just go on and on the responsibilities the EPA is carrying out with a staff that really isn't that big compared to its compared to the rest of the federal government is a tiny, tiny percentage, and yet they do such an important job that is seen in every community. What we saw was three former EPA administrators from two Republican administrations and one Democratic came forward and said the EPA simply could not do its job with these kind of cuts.
And as your title kind of harkens to, you know, it's not just, we're talking about climate specifically today, but it's not just pollution that impacts the climate that would be affected by EPA cuts. It's the air we breathe. It's all kinds of public health issues. It's water and the government's ability to restrict any kind of pollution or regulate any kind of pollution that would be impacted. So are those cuts up in the air or are they done or in process?
No, it's real. They are trying to, in many different ways, trying to get rid of staff. And I think as Brent said, it's important to remember that these executive actions, that means right from the top, right from President Trump and his administrators at each of the agencies, those are very much under in flux right now because there's lawsuits over all of them. And they've had to reinstate people. One of my colleagues wrote about they basically laid off the whole environmental justice staff at EPA, but then brought some of them back. It was kind of random which ones were brought back. And so they were brought back and they didn't have computers to do their work. So right now I would describe the situation as chaos, but you know, I've been covering Washington for a long time and it always, the budget is Congress's job. It is Congress's decision on how big the agencies should be. And in the first Trump administration, there was an effort to cut the EPA 30%, and Congress said no. They never went along with that. There may have been like an 8% cut in staff, and then it was level funding throughout the Trump administration. And Congress traditionally has not gone along with deep cuts because they know of the role of EPA in their communities and in their states. And I think what we're seeing now is the Trump administration is trying to do this without Congress. It'll be up to the courts and frankly up to Congress to decide whether they can go forward like that.
We're going to turn it over to you, Brett, and it would be great to hear a little bit more about the impacts of cuts to staffing at NOAA, as well the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. I assume organizations like yours at Clean Wisconsin rely on data that NOAA produces.
Yeah, exactly. You know, both the cuts at EPA, NOAA, other federal agencies, you know, Forest Service, all these places, it's like a fundamental issue of the administration kind of spurning the expertise that the federal government has built over decades and decades of implementing these laws and making trying to make every issue of climate and environmental protection a political issue. And like Marianne hinted at, you know, that's not the case. Just for example, on climate, there's all kinds of studies out on this kind of stuff, but I pulled one up from 2023 data that found that 77% of Americans believe that climate change is a serious threat to humanity, and 68% support policies to tackle climate change. So, you know, these are not partisan issues. And when you go at a agency like NOAA, like you said, they're data, you know, they don't have a ton of programs or things that they're doing on the ground other than tracking what's going on. So, you know, to me, those cuts are also really problematic, and it kind of makes sense if the administration doesn't want to deal with climate change. They also don't want one of their agencies talking about how bad it's getting. So that's, like I said, really troubling. And you know, NOAA, there's all kinds of implications of cuts there that I don't know much about, but I know farmers rely on NOAA. I know all of our weather apps rely on NOAA data. So it's just unclear to me why the administration thinks that NOAA, which deals with severe weather, deals with long-term forecasts that people rely on, that communities rely on to keep themselves safe, that major industries like agriculture rely on, you know, why those folks doing that science and research would be targeted is, you know, I believe it's really short-sighted.
And particularly troubling, of course, on the heels of the hottest year on record, 2024, when there were 27 confirmed. I'm taking these numbers from your organization's reporting, Marianne. 27 confirmed weather and climate disasters with losses exceeding $1 billion in the U.S. just last year. And as Brett was just saying, the information produced by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration helps us predict those kinds of disasters. So we're talking about real-world implications for a lot of people from these decisions. And the attacks on information seem to be also extending to education and the way government officials are allowed to talk about climate. And I know, Marianne, you've been doing some reporting recently on that. What's happening to climate change education in federal organizations such as the U.S. Coast Guard. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes. This is a story we just had over the weekend that the U.S. Coast Guard, and I should say this is another one of those federal agencies, actually this is a federal military service, that it's our main maritime law enforcement and search and rescue service, and they do an amazing job. They were there saving 11,000 people in Texas during Hurricane Harvey. They're out there on the coastline every day, and they're in the Arctic dealing with all that receding ice and the increasing shipping. So you can get the picture of where the Coast Guard is. The Coast Guard Academy got word over the last couple of weeks that it has to eliminate climate change from its curriculum. No more discussion of climate change in any of its classes. The Coast Guard comes under the Department of Homeland Security, and the Secretary, Kristi Noem, put out a directive saying climate change must be taken out of, that terminology must be removed from everything that DHS does. The Coast Guard Academy officials said they really had no choice but to remove it. And they say, well, we're going to teach them these things. We're going to teach them meteorology. We're going to teach them oceanography without using the word climate change. Well, education experts say that's just not viable. If you're really studying these issues, you're looking at the science, you're supposed to be inspecting the scientific studies, you're supposed to be questioning assumptions, testing them. For you not to be allowed, and this really is a classic case of censorship, from you having to avoid certain things, saying certain things, it's just, it kind of flies in the face of what education is all about. But moreover, we talked to the former commandant of the Coast Guard, and he is very concerned about this because he said we're going to end up with a Coast Guard that just is less capable, less ready. And these young cadets who are studying at the Coast Guard, he said they are going to have this climate change on their watch. It's a reality they will face for the next few decades. They have to be educated for that and not just for the political realities of the next 4 years.
Yeah, particularly you can imagine in a time of rising sea levels, the Coast Guard is going to be confronting that firsthand, and not having that kind of knowledge is like you said, really potentially endangering or hazardous. I want to do a quick follow-up with you, Marianne, and then talk with both of you before we wrap about action. But do you foresee, have you anything in your reporting leading you to see analogous things happening across education systems in the U.S. that's sort of beyond the Coast Guard or a federal agency, where the government, the Trump administration is saying we need to remove climate change from educational curricula, or student organizations associated with working on climate need to be removed, something analogous to what's happening with the anti-DEI efforts? Is there anything coming up in your reporting so far about that?
Right. And you heard that $400 million was taken away from Columbia University because what it was perceived as anti-Semitism there. So I would say all of higher education is on alert from that action, that the federal government is going to be scrutinizing them, and the DEI and climate change are very high up on their list of things. And most higher education relies on the federal government for some part of its budget. But this is in the air, this whole censorship thing. Just last year, Florida, under Governor DeSantis, told textbook publishers that they should take climate change out of science textbooks if they want them to be used in Florida. Similar discussion is going on right now in Iowa. And so I would say for those who care about climate change education and feel we need even more focus on it, it's kind of a disturbing trend.
I don't want to leave there. We just have a couple of minutes. I don't want to leave on that note, so I'm going to bounce it back to Brett here to tell us a little bit more about maybe like 1 minute or so about Clean Wisconsin and action you're all involved in right now, and what you're encouraging folks to do if they want to get involved.
Sure. So Clean Wisconsin is the state's oldest and largest environmental nonprofit. We were founded on Earth Day 55 years ago. We were originally called Wisconsin's Environmental Decade and learned that it was going to take more than 10 years to solve all the problems. So here we are today as Clean Wisconsin. But we've got a great team. I'm one of our lawyers. We've got a legal staff, but we also have policy folks focused on agriculture and water issues, climate, energy, air. We've got staff scientists and a resilient communities program that's focused on helping communities around the state, and particularly in Milwaukee, make their own communities more resilient to climate change. So there's all kinds of ways that we're working. We advocate at the state and federal level. We are, involved in the state house and in Congress at the federal level, bring lawsuits when we need to. And, we really just try to be the voice in Wisconsin, both with our own leaders here, but also nationwide, about, the things that Wisconsin communities care about. I spend a lot of my time in front of the Public Service Commission, that is our state agency that regulates utilities. And, I want to kind of use it as an example of ways folks can get involved, because these decisions are regardless of what's happening in DC, these decisions are happening at all levels of government. So my advice to people would be to pay attention, get involved in your local communities, in your local government, talk about it with friends and family. You can join our action network at cleanwisconsin.org, and there's all kinds of other good organizations doing great work. So be part of the movement that's going to keep climate change progress moving forward.
Thank you. That's Brett Cordy, staff attorney at Clean Wisconsin. Thanks so much for coming in, Brett.
Great to be here.
We've also had with us today Marianne Lavelle, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the nonprofit news organization Inside Climate News. Thanks so much for joining us, Marianne.
Thank you, Douglas.
It's been a real pleasure talking with both of you. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today. If you've appreciated the show, please share it on WRT's online archive or wherever you find your podcasts. I'm your host, Douglas Haynes. I'd like to thank today's engineer, Andrew Thomas, producer Sarah Gabler, news director Shali Pittman, and receptionist Amy Lutsky. And thank you, listeners, for joining us today on A Public Affair here at WRT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned for Madison Book Beat. Yeah.
Recorded with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen
and support. BBC News with Sue Montgomery. It's now thought that at least 6,000 Syrians have crossed into neighbouring Lebanon in the last few days to escape violence in the coastal provinces of Latakia and Tartus. The area is a stronghold of the ousted former president Bashar al-Assad, and hundreds of civilians were killed there by the new government's security forces. The BBC's Karine Torby has been speaking to refugees in a border village.
They told us they came without any belongings, in fear for their safety, for their security.